New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, joined by PEI, pardon. The guys from all the Canadas got on a steamship. They bought a lot of champagne for their Charlottetown trip. Confederation Canada was just a dream. Then some men got together and they started to scheme. Mother Britain set us free. We became our own country.
It's 8 p.m. and you're listening to Each for All, the Cooperative Connection on Vancouver Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM, and online at cooperadio.org. I'm Sandy Goldman, and tonight we're going to discuss the state of our Canadian Federation as the dispute over the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion continues to heat up. Every day it seems there's a new development concerning the fate of the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion. Today, for example, the BC government announced it's suing Alberta over its new law aimed at restricting oil and gas shipments to BC. And in the war of words between BC, Alberta, and the federal government, we've heard the term unconstitutional getting a lot of airtime. We've asked a special guest to help us make sense of this debate from a legal perspective. Jack Woodward is a BC-based Aboriginal and constitutional lawyer, and we've reached him by phone from his home in Campbell River. Good evening, Jack. Are you with us?
Oh, hi, Sandy. Yes, I sure am.
Okay. Well, it's great to have you here tonight. I want to set a bit of context for where the country finds itself now, at least constitutionally. So you let me know if I'm on the right track. My Canadian history class, way back when, taught me that up until 1982, we had a classic division of powers between the federal and provincial governments. Would that be correct?
Yes, I think you're on the right track.
Okay, but when the Constitution was repatriated in 1982, things started to change. And one part in particular that you had a hand in was the development of Section 35 that recognizes and affirms the rights of Indigenous people. Is that right?
Yeah, there's a great history there, you know. When Trudeau was persuaded to run again, as Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau, and he had lost the election in 1979, and he was persuaded to run again for the 1980 election against the Prime Minister Joe Clark. He agreed to run again, but he told his caucus, look, if you want me to run again, here's my shopping list. I want a Charter of Rights. And so they said, okay, that'll be the Parliament's agenda, and he agreed to run again. Now, then he also said, I want it to pass through Parliament unanimously. That was a bit of a wish list, but that's what he wanted. And so he sought the approval and the agreement of all of the parties in Parliament, including the Tories, who they had a few things they wanted, and the NDP, which was the third party at the time. It was Ed Broadbent was the leader of the NDP at the time, and Ed Broadbent said, "Well, I'll tell you what the NDP wants. We want something in this constitution for Aboriginal people." It was very brave of Broadbent to do that at the time, because he didn't have an awful lot of leverage. I mean, this was just something that Trudeau wanted. There was no constitutional requirement that he have unanimous. And, you know, if Broadbent had argued too hard, he might not have gotten something. But he said, okay, here's what I want. And so I've always admired Ed Broadbent for that. The tiny role that I had was that they needed someone to write a first draft in haste, I should say. And I banged out a first draft, which bears some vague resemblance to what eventually happened. Of course, I had no further involvement. It went through many different politicians and committees, which I'd had nothing to do with that. And what came back was, there's only a few words that are recognizable, but Ian Waddell, you know, who's still a lawyer in Vancouver, he was a member of Parliament at the time, the member of Parliament for the riding of Kingsway, and he was instrumental in this whole process, and he still has that original that thing that I typed in 1981, I think it was. He has it framed, including his handwritten notes on it. I typed out a thing. He made some handwritten notes, and then it went off into the ether. And eventually, we saw Section 35, which was sponsored by the NDP.
And it passed, and we have changes that came from that. So now we have to include the rights of Indigenous people as we're moving forward. And that's a very important part of the story concerning Trans Mountain that we'll want to focus on. But, Jack, the reason I asked you to join us is because in listening to the debate and various interviews over the last month, I've heard you talk about something called cooperative federalism. And since our show reports on cooperative efforts each week, I wondered, well, what does cooperative federalism mean, and where did it originate? So why don't we start there?
Okay. Well, first of all, I hope that I don't disappoint people who are interested in the cooperative movement when you learn that the meaning of cooperative federalism is a slightly more limited meaning for the word cooperative than we might hope, but it's still a huge and important advance on how our Constitution is interpreted, and it's a recent development. It originated with former Chief Justice Dixon. He was one of the we've had two really great Chief Justices in Canada of worldwide reputation, not just Canadian, and that was Chief Justice Dixon and now Madam Justice McLaughlin, now retiring as Chief Justice. She's really head and shoulders above any jurist we've seen in really almost any country. And they advanced the idea of cooperative federalism. And what cooperative federalism means is that there's not going to be any bullies. There's not going to be any constitutional bullies. So when you read, you mentioned the old classic division of powers. So in a federal state, you always have a list of who of what the national government has as its powers and what the regional, state, provincial government have as their powers. That's the essence of a federal state, and that's true in United States, Canada, Australia, Germany, lots of other countries. So, in the classic view, you create these compartments, watertight compartments, where each jurisdiction has its own sphere of legislative jurisdiction, and they can do what they like, and the other jurisdiction has to get out of the way. Well, what cooperative federalism recognizes is that that's unrealistic. In a modern country, every single thing that a government does, either at the national level or at the regional level, affects the other government. And so what the court has said is that they're going to interpret every dispute whenever it is at all possible to allow all statutes to operate at the same time, both federal and provincial, and they're not going to pick favorites. So that's sort of a short version of it. Here's what, can I read you a very short quote from Chief Justice
Yes,
Dixon?
Of course, yes.
He said, "In principle, there would seem to be no good reasons to speak of paramountcy and exclusion, except where there is actual conflict in operation, where one enactment says yes and the other says no, and where the same citizens are being told to do inconsistent things, and where compliance of one law is defiance of the other." So that's the only times when somebody gets to play the constitutional trump card, if I can call it that. Otherwise, both laws are going to be allowed to prevail. So then we come to should we jump right into the Kinder Morgan and how it applies to that?
Yes, I just wanted to back up for one sec. When Chief Justice Dixon, was he the first to pronounce on that idea of what, without getting too technical, when was that, and what kind of case was he referring to that went all the way to the Supreme Court?
Well, that was in 1982, and you know, I read the legal words, and I can't remember what that case was about. Often they're dealing with regulatory cases. That one wasn't a dramatic conflict about a pipeline, for example. We've had that in British Columbia already, you know. Justice Marvin K. Koenigsberg of the British Columbia Supreme Court, had to deal with the Northern Gateway pipeline.
Exactly.
And she made it. Yeah, she made a decision early in 2016. The case is called Coastal First Nations, and she talked about whether or not Parliament's so-called jurisdiction over interprovincial pipelines was an ultimate power, or if it was moderated in some way by provincial powers. This is a great topic, and I hope that we have some time this evening to talk about that.
Yes, exactly. Now, Jack, what you're saying here, if I understand it correctly, is that under the guise of cooperative federalism, and we're in a federation here, can two different laws exist at one time? And by that I mean Ottawa declaring, well, we're going to get the pipeline built in the national interest, but BC also saying it's concerned about the safety of diluted bitumen flowing across its territory and on the coast. Can those two things exist at the same time?
Yeah, well, so first of all, British Columbia has not yet said that there's no chance of building the pipeline. British Columbia has taken a reference to the BC Court of Appeal on a proposed law, and BC's proposed law regulates the pipeline in extreme detail. It regulates it in such a detailed way that it may well be discouraging for the proponent. When I read that proposed legislation, it's the reference case says, basically, dear court, can we pass this law? And then attaches the law that they propose to pass. And that's what the reference case is. And so you can read what the British Columbia government is planning to do. It's fascinating. And when I read that law, maybe I'm just a typical British Columbian, but it looks completely reasonable to me. It looks like a very reasonable law. It says all the right things. It says, look, you can't just put a pipeline in with disregard to the health and safety of British Columbia residents and a whole bunch of other things. And it says if you want to transport a hazardous material through British Columbia through a pipeline, here's the hoops you have to jump through. And, nobody likes excessive regulations, but when I read those regulations and you consider the hazard that's introduced, just to me, as a lay person, I'm not a pipeline operator, they look reasonable to me. It looks like, okay, yeah, you should be careful about whether or not the pipeline is properly constructed and whether or not it goes through highly populated areas and whether or not the material in the pipe, if it spills, is going to cause a danger to health and safety and whether or not it could spill into the marine environment and what kind of plan you have in place in case it does spill and whether or not you're able to post a sufficient bond to pay for the cost of the cleanup, all of that. So that's what the BC reference case is about. That's what that's about. And so, we may have to wait for the court to make that decision, but if I was to bet on it, I'd say the BC Court of Appeal will look at that and say, looks reasonable to us, because it is reasonable.
But Jack, at the same time, do they have the constitutional authority or jurisdiction as a province to be concerned about those things, or does the national interest, as the Prime Minister keeps saying, and the Premier of Alberta as well, override that? And how does that fit into the idea of cooperative federalism? I might be on the right wrong track here, but
you're exactly on the right track. There's a couple of things. This raises so much, and we could talk for a long time. But let me just say, first of all, the reason that that Canada keeps talking about the national interest is for a legal reason. Our constitution, the part of what we're talking about was written in 1867, and they didn't have pipelines, and so what the federal government is having to do is read an obscure clause of the Constitution, which is Section 9110C, in which, in order to create out of thin air an area of federal jurisdiction over something that didn't exist in 1867, there has to be an act of Parliament declaring this work, with a capital W, to be for the, quote, general advantage of Canada, unquote. So what Trudeau is doing by making this constant pronouncement is trying to build up a case in the minds of the judges who will hear that case that this is for the general advantage of Canada, because if they can't pass that test, they're not even out the door, first of all. So Canada's legislation, they'll have to pass a separate law authorizing this pipeline. They haven't done this yet. And that law has to say it's for the general advantage of Canada. The existing National Energy Board Act is not enough. So they have to pass a separate law. And so it'll be the conflict between that law and the provincial enactment that John Horgan has referred to the BC Court of Appeal. Assuming both of those laws get enacted, there'll be a conflict between those laws. And that's when the question of cooperative federalism comes in.
Right.
Your background... Sorry.
No, go ahead, Jack.
Your default position now in Canada is that both laws will coexist. That's what cooperative federalism means, is that if at all possible, the courts will uphold both laws at the same time. Now, you and I, we're just lay people, but we can see how you could uphold both laws. Parliament passes a law saying we authorize this pipeline for the general advantage of Canada, and British Columbia says, okay, you can build the pipeline, but you have to jump through all these hoops. Both laws survive. That's the scenario that's coming down the road. And if both laws survive, then we're into a kind of an excruciating process of Kinder Morgan applying for these provincial permits and basically the BC cabinet being able to make a judgment call about whether or not the safety regulations being put in place by Kinder Morgan, much more stringent safety regulations than the National Energy Board would put in place, whether or not the provincial safety regulations are sufficient. And so that's where it really comes to the crunch. If the BC cabinet, if we get to this stage, I don't think we're going to get to this stage, but if we get to that point where the BC cabinet looks at all of the hoops that they've created and Kinder Morgan's attempt to jump through those hoops, and the BC cabinet says, you know, we're still not satisfied, then you're going to have another court case about whether or not the BC cabinet has been capricious or not, or whether or not they actually had genuine reasons to be concerned.
So, Jack, just to paraphrase here, kind of get the gist of it, what I'm hearing you say is that, first of all, Ottawa has to draft legislation to say that getting this pipeline built, I forget the words you used, but let's just say is in the national interest.
That's right. The words are general advantage of Canada.
General advantage of Canada. That law has not yet been proposed.
Well, we have the National Energy Board Act, but there's certainly a good argument to be made that as it stands, it doesn't authorize this pipeline. Or this expanded pipeline. So that's the first hurdle. Now, I could be wrong about that. It might be that the National Energy Board Act fulfills that requirement, but that weakens Canada's case. The reason it weakens Canada's case is that these words, the general advantage of Canada, are an exception to a general rule that all of that kind of stuff is a provincial matter. So, you see, Canada is trying to squeak through a keyhole here. Just for the history buffs here, the way the 1867 Constitution was written is that the federal powers are in Section 91 and the provincial powers are in Section 92. In the middle of Section 91, and in the middle of Section 92, that's the provincial section, is Section 10, which says works, with a capital W, works and undertakings, with a capital U, those things are provincial. Except, so they're creating an exception. And it's those ones that are declared by Parliament to be for a general advantage of Canada. Now, the federal government might argue that the National Energy Board Act already does that. I think that's thin ice for them. I think that they're going to have a hard time on that one because this is a new thing and it's a new era. But anyway, let's say I'm wrong about that. Let's say they're going to just hang their hat on the National Energy Board Act. They're still going to face cooperative federalism. They're still going to face it's been restated by the Supreme Court of Canada at least 15 times, right up until the Free De Beer case. which we could talk about, the Comeau case that happened
exactly
just a couple of months ago. They just keep saying it over and over. The old days of watertight compartments, the old days, there was a phrase called interjurisdictional immunity, which is a sort of a scary-sounding idea that each level of government had its own area of immunity. It's gone. That's swept away. And what's left is this idea of cooperative federalism, where, and you know, here's the example. Here's what it was built upon. Cooperative federalism was built on the idea that everybody in the country is a Canadian, and so the whole taxation, education, social welfare, and health part of our government is based on cooperative federalism. Every government has to be part of that overall system, federal and provincial and territorial. And that is a combination of legislative and administrative and bureaucratic cooperation. It's really it really works, you know, quite wonderfully. We have the equalization payments on a grand scale in Canada, where when a province gets poor, they're supported. When a province gets rich, they contribute. And that has, you think of how Alberta has benefited from that. Alberta's gone through tough times when they've been the recipients of equalization payments, and they've gone through boom times when they've been a payer into the equalization fund. And these are not just small amounts of money. These are huge amounts of money. So that's the origin of cooperative federalism. And now the spinoff to that is that in less obvious areas where there should be cooperation, the court is saying they're going to act as the referee, and nobody gets to be the bully. And the way they're, you know, they can't tell legislatures what to do, but the way they will enforce this is they're going to allow every law to prevail to the greatest extent possible. So the Kinder Morgan pipeline is actually a textbook case of how this will work out. Canada passes a law allowing the pipeline. British Columbia passes a law regulating it to an excruciating degree. And if everything the Supreme Court of Canada has been saying for the last 20 years is true, I should say 30 years, then both laws will have to be allowed to exist.
So that we are in British Columbia, what I think I'm hearing you say, well within our rights to look at what is going to be flowing through that pipeline and across our lands and onto tankers through our coastline with a fine-tooth comb for the health and safety of our residents, our land, our sea, our air. Does that seem kind
Absolutely.
Of like what we're doing here? And in the same way that the Comey case in New Brunswick, I guess, reaffirmed that the province of New Brunswick has the right to regulate I guess it's beer in that case, the amount of beer that was able to flow into the province from other provinces. It upheld that. That was the Supreme Court a few weeks ago. Was that kind of a parallel to provincial rights?
It's a great parallel. For technical reasons, the court referenced cooperative federalism but didn't actually rely on it. But here's what happened. The Constitution, in that case, actually has a clause that says there's free trade between the provinces. It actually says that. And unlike the current case where there isn't, the word interprovincial pipeline don't appear in the Constitution. They're a judge-made creation, right? So judges can both create and destroy, right? But the Constitution doesn't say pipelines anywhere in it. It does say free trade, though. And so in the face of the clause that says free trade, New Brunswick imposed a provincial tariff, basically a tax barrier to bringing beer from a different province. And you know, I think most lawyers and judges thought that New Brunswick was going to lose that case because it just seemed such a flagrant violation of the free trade clause in the Constitution. And here comes the Supreme Court of Canada and says, you know what? We're going to uphold New Brunswick's law because basically they don't want to strike down anyone's laws. Now, you earlier on mentioned the charter, and Aboriginal rights, which we should come to, because there are certain cases where the courts will strike down laws. But in the normal division of powers tiff between the national government and the regional governments, between Canada and the provinces, the trend is very strongly that all laws will be upheld unless it's absolutely impossible. Now, I would think that in the Kinder Morgan case, it's pretty transparent that Canada can authorize the building of a pipe and British Columbia can regulate its safety and health and the environment and all that. I wouldn't even think that's controversial in terms of the legal analysis of it. Judges have already said that. So, but then when you get to the question of Aboriginal rights, then we're in a whole different department of the law. So that was the big news in 1982, is that instead of there just being constitutional issues dividing Canada and the provinces, now there's constitutional protection for Aboriginal rights.
Well, Jack, sorry to interrupt there. Yeah. That is going to frame the whole second part of our discussion here.
Okay.
So let's hold on to that. I think we've laid a good foundation here in trying to understand cooperative federalism and how that, you know, is supposed to be working. I can't really, none of us can see that it is working right now, but the courts, I guess, will decide in the heated battle of politics and all of that right now. But let's take a short break and remind listeners that you're tuned in to Each for All, the Cooperative Connection on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM and online at coopradio.org. We'll resume our interview with Jack Woodward in a few minutes.
A wise old bird once told me, and I believe it's true, he said the world's full of different birds with different points of view. But sometimes there's a job so big, if we want to get it done, we've got to bring those birds together and all work as one. And that's cooperation.
And we're back on Vancouver Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM, and online at cooperadio.org. I'm Sandy Goldman, and you're listening to Each for All, the Cooperative Connection. Thanks to Big Bird and friends for emphasizing that when we put our heads together, we can figure it out. And that's what we're hoping for here in our discussion tonight of the heated debate around the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion. And we've got a special guest with us, Jack Woodward, a lawyer on both Aboriginal issues and constitutional issues. Jack, are you still there?
Hey, Sandy, I sure am.
Let's talk. Sorry, go ahead.
The little song, that's hilarious, that little song you just played. I have a little story to tell you about the about a connection between the cooperative movement and one of the great Aboriginal cases that's still continuing in Canada.
Okay, let's go for it.
Well, the Beaver Lake Cree Nation in Alberta, Lac La Biche, are on the edge of the tar sands, and they're trying to stop the further expansion of the tar sands.
Right.
And I started a case for them in 2007 about their treaty rights, about how the tar sands, this huge industrial development, the biggest industrial development in the world at the time, was encroaching upon their treaty rights. But of course, it was an incredibly expensive case. Out of the blue, I got a call from someone in Manchester. The cooperative bank, the biggest credit union in the world, centered in Manchester.
Manchester, England?
Manchester, England.
Right.
They, of course, it's the historic origin of the modern co-op movement, right?
Oh,
in the
wow.
1840s, that's where it originated, and there's still a very powerful cooperative movement in Britain. They had some financial problems recently, but they will survive. They've been going for 150 years or more, and they're carrying on. But every year, and they have a huge fund for discretionary spending that the members vote on. And in 2007, the members of the Cooperative Bank in the United Kingdom voted that they want their money spent on fighting the climate change. And they authorized their executive to look around the world and find out where in the world was the worst thing happening to do with climate change. And they thought that the Alberta tar sands was probably the worst thing. And they thought, well, how can we influence that? And they said, well, this little fight that the Beaver Lake Cree Nation is fighting, that would be good to support that. And they actually just phoned me up. I just about fell out of my chair.
Wow.
And for a couple of years, they financially supported the Beaver Lake Cree Nation out of cooperative funds, the funds raised by the members. And you know, they have like grocery stores and funeral homes and gas stations, as well as their huge credit union. And their distribution funds that they distribute, they put some of them aside for good works, and they supported the little Beaver Lake Cree Nation in their fight against the tar sands. It was kind of a nice interface between the cooperative movement.
That's really neat. Thanks for sharing that. So, how did that case turn out, or are you still working on it?
They have a different lawyer now, and they're carrying on. Yeah, they're it's a monumental David and Goliath type struggle, but they're doing their best.
Okay, so we were talking about cooperative federalism, the classic division of powers between the federal government and the provinces, and you know, we're kind of leaning towards you know, hoping that the courts will decide that BC can have its interests put forward around regulating and being concerned about the safety of diluted bitumen flowing across the territory and out to the coast, and Ottawa can do its part to get something built in the national interest, and you know, hopefully both sides can be considered and they can cooperate and come to some kind of agreement. But Jack, we started to say that in 1982 Section 35 of the Constitution was created, and you had a hand in the first draft or so supporting the idea of Indigenous rights, and now those need to be considered. And so where do Aboriginal rights fit into the current pipeline debate? Because on the one hand, the feds are saying they support the UN Declaration on Aboriginal Rights, yet also repeat this pipeline will get built. And we know that there are quite a number of cases, 14 or so, of coastal First Nations and others in the interior, the Coldwater case, where they're saying, no, we don't want this pipeline. So again, how can you do both? Is that also a case of cooperative federalism, this time between the federal government and First Nations?
Yeah, well, as a legal term, it doesn't apply to that relationship. It's quite different. If you think about the fact that Aboriginal rights, that's Aboriginal rights, treaty rights, and Aboriginal title, those are the three categories under Section 35, that part of the Constitution is parallel to the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, freedom of the press, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, that kind of stuff. And so all of those laws, the fundamental freedoms and Aboriginal rights, act as a supervisory part of the Constitution over anything that Canada or British Columbia can do. So they're almost a higher order of constitutional power than the mere division of powers between Canada and the provinces. So yes, it's a serious problem for someone who wants to build a pipeline, because you can't just say the First Nations. They are individual nations, and they each have their own concerns. Many of them consent to the idea of a pipeline in return for various considerations, often money. You know, some of them have agreed to the pipeline in return for a large payment from Kinder Morgan. But the consent of a few doesn't amount to it. You would really need 100% of the First Nations to agree. Now, I don't want to paint this too starkly. It is theoretically possible for Canada to pass a law that overrides the Aboriginal rights that it's infringing upon, but it would be very hard. If they don't get consent, they have to beat their way through the the process, the justification process that was laid down by the Supreme Court of Canada as long ago as 1988. And that was with a case called Sparrow that comes out of Vancouver, right? That's the famous fishing case out of Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And so what's that? 30 years ago, that law has only been strengthened and improved upon since it was first pronounced in Sparrow. That sets out a system whereby federal or provincial legislation could purport to infringe upon an Aboriginal right. But we actually don't have any examples of this magnitude of a law that has successfully been enacted to infringe a right and survived what's called the justification analysis. We don't have a single example. So this is a very high bar for Canada to overcome. If they're not going to seek consent all the way down the line, I'd be discouraged if I was the federal government, because it would be really hard to do this without consent. If they wanted to bully their way through, wow, that's going to be tough. First of all, they would have to, the First Nation, first of all, has to assert that they have a right that would be infringed. They have to show that there would be infringement of their right.
And is that, sorry, Jack, is that what's going on in the 14 or so cases that First Nations have? I think in front of the Federal Court of Appeal.
Right. Federal Court of Appeal. That is some of the cases, not all of the cases. Yes, there's a big glump of cases in the Federal Court of Appeal, which has reserved its decision, and we're waiting now. We've been waiting for, 6 months, which is normal. Courts take time to make, and we're glad of that. The courts take time to think carefully about their decision and then make them. And they're not limited by the May 31st deadline that Kinder Morgan has set. I mean, they're going to decide the law based on Canadian law, not based on the time deadline of an American corporation.
And Jack, in those cases, are some of the First Nations saying that their rights have been infringed upon?
Well, those cases are at a preliminary stage, so we haven't even got to the main workings, the main guts of the issue on a Section 35 case. What they're saying is they haven't even properly been consulted ahead of time. So there's, not to get too complicated, but there's two branches of the Section 35 law. The first branch is the consultation branch, which is what happens before government action takes place. The second branch is the infringement and justification branch, which is that usually involves a trial and involves a fairly complicated bunch of evidence and that, which will happen, of course. That'll be the second stage. So, yeah, the Federal Court of Appeal stuff is like the first round, but it's not the last word. There'll be a lot more to be heard from those First Nations that oppose this pipeline if it's going to go through. And what they will do is they'll first of all show that the pipeline infringes their rights. They have to get over that bar, and they may or may not succeed. But let's say they do. Then the onus passes over to the federal government to show that they can justify that. And they can't justify it by saying it's in the national interest. It's very interesting, and people often get mistaken about this. The law that infringes the Aboriginal rights can't just say, well, it's in the national interest. It has to also be in the interest of the Aboriginal nation.
And Jack, you said earlier that that kind of is a layer sort of above the national interest, or you said it's kind of a higher bar. Is that correct?
Oh yes, it supersedes the division of powers. So it's very much like it's like freedom of the press. Let's say that somebody came along and told you, Co-op Radio, you can no longer report about. Let's say there's a provincial law that said, we don't like, what you're saying about cooperatives. We don't want you. You would immediately go to the courts and argue freedom of the press. And it doesn't matter about division of powers. You wouldn't even get to the question of whether or not regulation of a broadcasting system, whether or not that's federal or provincial. You wouldn't even care about that, because the overriding law is freedom of the press. Now, it's the same here. The First Nations are not really concerned about whether it's authorized by Canada or by British Columbia or whatever. If the project itself infringes their rights and it can't be justified, the law authorizing that project will be struck down. It doesn't matter to them whether it's federal or provincial.
And Jack, you know that last week, I think, or the week before, and I'm sorry, I don't have the name of the chief or chiefs of some local First Nations, went down to the shareholders meeting of Kinder Morgan to explain to the shareholders, I don't know if it was the AGM or what, and I'm sorry, I can't be accurate on that, to tell them exactly what you're saying so that they were aware of the power of the Aboriginal concerns and what might stop the pipeline from going through, I guess, to educate them about those laws and possible infringement and what that means within Canada. And I personally, I thought that was a great exercise.
Absolutely. And I just hope that we're not all being gamed by... I'm sure this isn't the case, but I hope that we're not being gamed by Kinder Morgan as if they are just playing with Canada. And I also hope that politicians like Trudeau and Notley are not posturing so that they look good trying to defend a project that they know is doomed to fail. That's what I'm worried about. I hope that they're sincere in what they're saying. Even though I disagree with what they're saying, that would be much better that they're sincere than that they're merely trying to say after the fact, once the project's gone, they can say, well, we tried our best.
Well, I think for them to save political face, you know, that's the political part of it.
One hopes that Canadian politicians wouldn't behave that way, right? That they would be sincere about what they say and they mean what they say. And so if we take it at face value, if we take Justin Trudeau at face value saying this pipeline is going to be built, it's a bit naive because he hasn't dealt with Aboriginal rights. And it's also, it's naive because he hasn't dealt with the fact that there's cooperative federalism. He has to accommodate what the province wants with respect to this pipeline. Secondly, it's naive because it doesn't deal with Aboriginal rights. And finally, it contradicts his own policy of supporting the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People,
right,
which requires free, prior, and informed consent.
Exactly. Now, Jack, we're getting close to the end of the hour. I just wanted to talk about what I think is a precedent here, and that was the case, and I think you mentioned that earlier, where the Northern Gateway pipeline was halted a few years ago, and that was going to run from Alberta through northern BC and out to the coast. What happened in that case? That did involve Aboriginal rights, did it not?
Absolutely, and it went to the British Columbia Supreme Court. A group of First Nations called Coastal First Nations, they took on that name, went to the British Columbia Supreme Court, and they got a judgment from Madam Justice Koenigsberg in which she addressed these exact issues, in which she said, the lawyer who won that case was Joe Arvey, who happens to be the lawyer that the province has hired to take its reference to the BC Court of Appeal. So he's got some experience on this. He made the successful argument to Madam Justice Koenigsberg that, yes, even though Canada may have jurisdiction over interprovincial pipelines, by the way, I'm not sure that's the case, but let's say that's true, then she said, but that's not the end of the story. What about health, safety, environment, all of those things? The province clearly has that jurisdiction. And so that's a cooperative federalism decision where she said, look, it was not her decision that killed the pipeline, not directly, but it was certainly, one of the nails in the coffin. But the declarations that she made about how the law works are absolutely crystal clear, and they're right in the mainstream of Canadian law. They're not only persuasive and perhaps binding on other judges, but they're an indication of what all courts are going to decide, which is yes, Canada may well be able to order that the pipe be built, but British Columbia can pass very extensive regulations about what happens in that pipe. So extensive of regulations that you might be better to carry the bitumen in buckets rather than try to put it through that pipe.
But Jack, just to be clear, did that case? Did that involve? You said Coastal First Nations. Did the Madam Justice Koenigsberg speak to the First Nations issues there? In other words, was there a precedent set there for, you know, duty to consult or whatever?
No, that's more what's being dealt with by the Federal Court of Appeal right now. No, her decision was primarily about federal versus provincial.
Okay.
It's really a foreshadowing of what this reference case is that has just been sent to the BC Court of Appeal.
Okay. Well, Jack, you know, we could go on, and I wish we had more time, but I think we've done a good job here of discussing cooperative federalism. We have a recent case, this one, the Northern Gateway one, and others. We learned tonight that First Nations rights here, according to Section 35, supersede the federal-provincial equation, and the whole thing is very, very fluid. How do you think this is going to turn out? And what about that May 31st deadline? Final thoughts?
Well, I think the May 31st deadline is empty. There's no jurisdiction of them to create that deadline. And so, what I think the way it's going to work out is, I think that this pipeline is already dead. I think that Kinder Morgan knows that. They're trying to extort some, I shouldn't say extort, they're trying to extract some benefit for the company on their way out the door. That's what I think is happening. And unfortunately, I think that Notley and Trudeau are playing a political game. You know, Notley is not going to win the next election in Alberta. And Trudeau is, I think, has forgotten his roots here. You know, he's forgotten the promises he made to First Nations. He's forgotten that, you know, British Columbia is an important part of the country. And so, you know, the pipeline's not going to happen. The barriers against it being built are formidable. And British Columbia is no slouch, right? So it's unfortunate that they've taken up so much of our time and energy. And they should have been cooperative. They should have started instead of confrontation. This is what the Supreme Court of Canada has said over and over again. Don't start with the confrontation. Start with what you've got, common ground, and build from that.
Right. Emphasizing, as Big Bird said, that when we put our heads together, we can figure it out. Exactly. Jack Woodward, it's so good to get your perspective on this. Thanks for joining us tonight, and we might call on you again as things develop. Would that be okay?
It's my honor. Thank you. And congratulations on the work you're doing on Co-op Radio.
Thanks so much. That's Jack Woodward, a BC-based Aboriginal and constitutional lawyer. Thanks to my fellow cooperators for helping produce tonight's program. I'm Sandy Goldman, wishing you all a very cooperative week and hoping that we'll hear some progress on the cooperative federalism front. Have a cooperative week.